So the God answered, you know, doesn't answer anything. I mean, I just had a debate with a theologian at a recent conference, and he, you know, basically said, what's your explanation for morality and good and evil? And anyway, I just kind of summarized everything you and I have been talking about for about 10 minutes. And then I said, okay, so that's my explanation. What's yours? He goes, well, you know, God did it. It's like, but that's not an explanation. I mean, how did God do it? Why did God do it? What was the process? I mean, you can't just say that, right? It's not an answer.
Just like I'm naked, or I'm epistemologically naked about what created the universe, you are about what created God. But I'm more able to update my priors because I have the questioning of my priors made explicit, and it doesn't take a funeral to update the priors of this society. The wokes properly claim that there are some borders should be stumbled upon and just destroyed because it's just a parochial convention, but not all are. We have some solid borders. Sex is one. And once you fight against that, you're fighting against truth, and you will lose elections if you keep fighting truth. So try fighting the laws of nature. Come on, it's ridiculous. A very good way to prove this is one-upping them and saying, okay, so we can destroy the border of sex, right? Why don't we destroy the border of species? What if I identify myself as a horse? Can I be a horse? Of course not. That's fucking ridiculous. But if they go with that, okay, then let me be an Apache helicopter. Can I be an Apache helicopter and be something that's not alive? Or the sun. I want to be the sun. It's just utterly ridiculous. There are borders, there's categories that make sense, that match into the environment. And if you keep breaking things, you will find something that breaks you. So, Michael, from your book, let me quote you a passage. The morality of holy books, most notably the Bible, is not the morality any of us would wish to live by. And thus, it is not possible for the religious doctrines derived from holy books to be the catalyst for moral evolution. Given how full, unquote, that's the end of the quote, given how full the Bible is of things that most cultures have given up for already a couple of centuries, on what foot are religious people standing to claim that the only religion can be used to derive ethics from?
Right. Well, so most religious people today have had their moral sphere expanded, just like the rest of us secularists, slow enough that you can barely see it over the course of decades and centuries. So they're hanging on to this idea of what's called divine command theory, that I get my morals from God. It's just something you say. I think the instinct is that without an outside source to validate a moral truth, then it's just relative. So they kind of set up this false dichotomy between moral relativism, in which anything goes, and some kind of absolute morality where there's an objective right and wrong. And, you know, of course, anybody that gives much thought to it realizes that it's a spectrum, not a black and white light switch of right and wrong, on and off, and so forth. And I think most people don't give a lot of thought to it. I think it's you know, fair to say that they haven't thought it through. It just seems like the right thing to say. I get my morals from the Bible. And then when you show them passages from the Old Testament or even the New Testament, really, that would be abhorrent, how you treat your slaves or stoning children to death for being disobedient or that kind of thing. Then they spin doctrine. They go, well, that's not really what that means. What that means is, and then they put a modern spin on it, even though preachers in the past would have gladly quoted those passages. And so most people, religious people today, get their morals like from the rest of us, from culture, from parents, from whatever, different perspectives and values, different countries and so on. But then they back into it some reasons why they believe whatever it is they believe. Like if you ask conservative Christians why they're pro-life on the abortion issue, which most of them are, you know, they'll say something like, well, because, you know, God says it's wrong. Well, how do you know? Well, it's in the Bible. It's actually not in the Bible. There's nothing about abortion in the Bible, short of a passage about if two men get in a fight and the woman, pregnant woman watching, gets hit and loses her fetus, then the one guy owes the other guy a lesser amount of money than had he killed the guy. So, I mean, the passage, really what the passage is saying is that the fetus is worth less than the full adult human, which is obviously correct. So they get that one right. But then people think, you know, well, there must be something in the Bible about abortion because, you know, my preacher tells me, or the minister says, or, you know, all the conservative Christians I know believe this. So they must have got it from the Bible. And of course they didn't. And if you say, well, you get your morals from God, it's reasonable to ask, well, how is it you're getting it? I mean, you're not God. So how are you talking to God? How is God communicating to you what's the right thing to do in this situation? You know, well, I pray on it. It's like, okay, do you actually hear the voice of God? You know, like a little voice in your head? Or, you know, is it just intuition you have? Like, it seems like the right thing to do is to, I don't know, to turn this wallet I found on the street back in to the local store or something like that, or to the police. And, you know, why would you think that's the right thing to do? You know, well, I'm a Christian person. Or anyway, but, you know, to be fair to most people, I don't think they think it through. You know, I mean, there's people that are professional ethicists, you know, philosophers and theologians and so on. They give this a lot of thought. In my opinion, the average person that just goes to church on Sundays, they're not really thinking any of this through. They go to church for social reasons. Their family and friends all go. There's free parking and babysitting. And they hear an inspirational sermon about, you know, you should be a good person and we should pray for, you know, Aunt Mary's cancer here in the pews. And by the way, there's, you know, there's this homeless thing. So we should all make a little donation to the church for manning the soup kitchens and, you know, that kind of stuff. And people are like, yeah, yeah, that seems like a nice thing to do. And you know, okay, fine. But that's not, you know, if you push them hard, like, well, what about this passage? Or what about that passage in the Bible? You know, most people have no idea this is even in there.
I thought you were about to quote another passage that I read this week on your book, The Moral Arc, that it said, if a man gets into a fight with another man and the wife of one of them separating them grabs the crutch of the other man, her hand should be cut off of her.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, come on, really? I mean, people say, well, that's a metaphoric, it's metaphorical. They don't mean literally cut off the hand, right? You know, so there's this kind of ways of spin doctoring those passages. You know, the Bible is it's a wiki. You know, it's a compilation of a lot of different stories and narratives and accounts and histories and poems and so on, all kind of cobbled together over centuries. In retrospect, readers, believers think, you know, it's kind of divinely inspired, so there must be some coherence. Narrative to the arc to the whole thing, or there's something objectively true about it, but really it's not. It's a mess. And it really takes biblical historians. I mean, I admire these people like Bart Ehrman who do this for a living. I mean, it's a lifelong project of figuring out, well, what every single sentence has a particular meaning in history. I have a whole bookcase over there of nothing but biblical interpretation volumes. I mean, it's like a 27-volume set for the entire Bible, in which every single sentence is dissected and explained and discussed by professional Bible scholars and so on. It depends on which Bible you're reading, which interpretation, which language. And then, you know, the way this word was used, you know, 2,000 years ago does not mean what it means today. In any case, we're reading it in English. There was no English 2,000 years ago, and so on and so on. So you have to really interpret the Bible, and it's a massive project. It's one of the reasons I ended up not going into biblical studies and theology in college, which is what I originally was going to do at Pepperdine. I went to Pepperdine University. It's a Church of Christ school. And I was a Christian at the time, and I thought, oh my God, this is a massive undertaking. I'm not that interested in it. And you have to get a PhD in theology, you had to master Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, and Latin so you could read all these long-dead languages so you understand what these passages mean. I mean, really understand. You got to really know the language. And I thought, this is really not my thing. I really like science, so I switched fields. But yeah, the people that do this, they'll tell you the average biblical reader, Christian or whatever, just reading these, they have no idea what the history of these stories mean.
I think you were pointing there at a crucial point, that the process that led to the emergence of the Bible or really any book, anything that we could conceive of as having more complexity than just an atom, or has emerged out of a process of variation and selection. There's really not other process. And the same evolution that the Christians oppose, because it supposedly decenters humans and shows that we are not the center of life in this planet, it's the same process that led to the emergence of the Bible. If you see how many people contributed to it, it's not just one dude who was very enlightened and got the signal from the sky. It's a concatenation of many things throughout thousands of people across hundreds of years that led to what it is right now. It has a lot of wisdom and a lot of retrograde things, as we've been talking about, but it's very interesting that there's only variation and selection as a process to lead to any emergence of anything. Mm. And the same people that oppose the process, the same scripture that they so much like, emerge out of it.
Yeah, well, I mentioned Bart Ehrman. His latest book is Love Thy Stranger, and it's about the spread of the Christian doctrine that we should be nice to people that we don't know, that we're not related to, the strangers, you know, stranger in a strange land and all that stuff. And it's an account about, I mean, he's an atheist. He doesn't believe any of this stuff is real. But the people who believe it's real changed the way ancient peoples thought about ethics and how strangers should be treated. And this ultimately led to the development of, well, I mentioned soup kitchens, but, you know, charitable hospitals and places for the poor and, you know, safety nets to catch the downtrodden and fallen people and people that are hard on their luck. You know, much of the modern concept of taking care of people that can't take care of themselves, you know, the welfare state, actually comes from a biblical sort of Judeo-Christian, well, really it's Christian. It's Jesus's philosophy, at least as it was interpreted. I mean, you can literally read things that Jesus said about abandoning your family, and, you know, he was never married, didn't have kids, and, you know, basically set up a cult, and he told people, you know, you should leave your family and follow me. I mean, today, if somebody said that, we'd say, well, you're just a crazy cult leader, right? So, but the general idea that, well, I like the teachings, what they mean is, in the modern sense, I like the idea of being nice to people that are not our kin and kind and our immediate tribe members, because everybody's nice to your people you know and like. What about the strangers? Well, that's kind of a Christian idea. So, you know, I'm in favor of giving credit where credit is due. You know, is religion good or bad for the world? Well, it depends. It's good when it does good. It's bad when it does bad, right? You know, so again, when, you know, Christian-based charitable organizations man the soup kitchens and raise funds to, you know, help the victims of Hurricane Katrina, whatever. You know, there's always disasters around the world, and there are Christian nonprofits that's what they specialize in, and I support that. I even support them literally financially, because whatever it takes, it doesn't matter to me. Whatever it takes to help people, you know, lift themselves up, and you know, so, you know, credit goes to those who do it for those reasons. Okay, fine. You know, but then let's not ignore the dark side of religion also.
Yes, I wonder whether that decentering nature of Christianity, telling you that you should love your neighbor just as much as you love yourself, is something inherent of it or influenced by some other pre-Christian values that were already emerging in Greece and Athens. And because the decentering instinct is something that, yes, the Christians advocate for when it comes to you versus your neighbor in the good interpretations of the passages of the Bible, because in the bad ones, they tell you to pillage and kill and take the wives as for you to rape them. It, properly interpreted, the Bible says that you should decenter yourself. But the ultimate decentering is the Darwinian one, realizing that we are not at the peak of anything. We have the most developed prefrontal cortexes, and that allows us to do incredible stuff. But we are by no objective or rational sense the center of life in this planet. And the Copernican revolution, we're not at the center of the solar system. And our solar system is not at the center of the galaxy. And our galaxy is just one of billions. So there's no center here. And we're not at all part of it. And that's something that the religious people really don't like. So while they tell you to decenter yourself and look at the absolute in one side, they don't want you to do it farther. You cannot one-up them, or they don't want you to.
That's funny. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. Certainly, that's the case. Of course, with morality, we're just dealing with, you know, how you treat other people and how other people treat you. Don't worry about the galaxies and all that stuff, right? But your point is that, you know, there's no outside objective source that's going to confirm or deny these particular moral truths. You know, we create these, but not randomly so. I mean, we do so based on our human nature. I mean, there's certain characteristics about who we are as a species, as a social primate species, for how we have to resolve conflict to get along in groups, for example. So, you know, almost all religions glommed onto ideas that, you know, truth-telling and honoring contracts and loving your spouse and being, you know, nice to other people. And so this is just kind of basic game theory strategies for how to develop friendships and have loving relationships and how to enforce trust within a group or else the group will fall apart, how to punish free riders and bullies who don't play by the rules. You know, there's a certain logic to it. And my argument is that religion got there first before ethicists and, you know, professional philosophers or whatever, game theorists and so on, which is fairly recent. You know, thousands of years ago, as these small bands and tribes of hunter-gatherers began to coalesce into larger chiefdoms and states, there had to be some system for conflict resolution. How are we all going to get along in these huge groups, hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, even millions of people? And so two institutions developed: government, the Leviathan. You know, we're going to have a state, a court system, a police system. You know, we're going to, here's the rules. Everybody gets a copy and we're going to enforce the rules. And if you don't do it, you're going to be in big trouble, buddy. You know, and by the way, if you think you got away with it because you didn't see any of the police around, there's an eye in the sky that sees everything, right? So that's religion in a way. Religion provides an internal governor, a kind of a moral sense of right and wrong and guilt and shame and pride and joy at doing the right thing, or guilt and shame at doing the wrong thing. You know, that's what, in a way, religion does. It says, even if you think nobody's watching you, God knows everything you're doing, right? So, I mean, that's kind of the whole point of an omniscient, omnipotent deity, is that they know everything. And so you should be good. Yeah, you should be good for goodness sake, but just in case there's somebody watching, right? And that made sense because, you know, in the early stages, really all the way up until recently, the Leviathan just did not have a long arm of the law to enforce the rules, right? So like you take the United States, the cobbling together of the United States, it happened over quite a long period of time, really two centuries, before it all kind of came together with the 50 states we have now. And, you know, in the, say, 19th century, when the West was really the Wild West, there was next to no Leviathan, no government. You know, there was, and so people had to resolve conflicts on their own. And so you see the development of kind of bottom-up systems, you know, of mining and cattle, you know, cattle herding and, you know, this farming, this kind of stuff, where people had to resolve these conflicts on their own. In that case, you know, religion is a system in place already. De Tocqueville made this note when he came to visit the United States from France, and wrote his famous Democracy in America book, in which he observed, you know, how, you know, religious Americans are, as a way of having an internal moral governor on themselves, because the state was not that effective, just not big enough to, you know, have a, you know, an infrastructure to enforce all this stuff.
Exactly. But interestingly, everything tells you what to do. It's not that religion has a monopoly on it. My thesis, and the one that we share to a big extent, is that you can derive a not from an is if there's an if. So if you want to survive, because you cannot do otherwise, you cannot last long not wanting to survive. So if you're going to want to survive, you have to drink water, avoid pathogens, and you derive a set of rules from understanding, given that we're going to survive. So underlying the religious or ethical standard, there's fitness. Without the fitness, you wouldn't be able to exist.
So I guess on the Izzat question, there's a built-in ought into your initial is, like, you know, that if you want to survive, why would you want to survive?
It couldn't be otherwise.
You know, ultimately, otherwise, there's nobody around to even ask the question, right? I mean, evolution designed us to survive and flourish, reproduce, et cetera. That's just who we are at base level. You know, you have to be alive to even ask these questions or talk about it. Why should you want to be, you know, why would you want to have food rather than be starving? Well, because I want to live. Yeah, but why do you want to live? You know, you can just keep asking why, and ultimately you just hit rock bottom because that's who we are as a species, right?
Yes.
So I'll read to you did I send you my truth book? I think I sent you
You did, yeah.
So I asked a professional philosopher. I'm not a professional philosopher, a historian of science, but Robert Pennock has written a lot about this. You know, the question of deriving an ought from an is. The way the argument works is to say, if you want to get a moral conclusion, you need at least one moral premise. It's not that there aren't factual premises, and I took this to be your main point, that science gives us some moral premises that make a difference. And that's exactly right. But the naturalistic fallacy doesn't say you can't have factual premises. It says you can't have only factual premises. You have to have something that has an ought such that together with the is, you can get an ought in the conclusion. And I would say that the way you make your argument is actually bringing in oughts into your premises. And so you're not actually denying the naturalistic fallacy. Really, you're accepting it, but building in some ought premises from the beginning. And that's the right way to do it. So just echoing exactly what you just said, you know, why should I care about being alive rather than dead or you know, nourished rather than starving? Well, because that's how evolution designed it. So if you want to say you're building an ought into your fundamental premise, yeah, that I guess that's right. But it's also an is. You know, it's just the way we are. You know, just that's what nature built. Period. Full stop.
I think that passage is equivalent to the Gödel's incompleteness theorem, that no explanation can explain itself or can fully explain itself. And that had to be the case, logically. You cannot get away from that. There has to be something. If you ask why that, well, because of this, and why that, because of this. Okay, but why that? I've got no clue. And that I don't have any clue about is the existence of the universe. The universe just exists. And because a lot of things happen, patterns of matter emerge, and the ones that replicate more are selected for emergence of life, and then the emergence of selection of natural selection based on what matches the environment. That's where we come from. So that's the axiom from which we have to build. And the religious people are also building from that. It's just that they add more things into it. And their explanatory, their pseudo-explanatory layer that they have, well, God created everything, but you have no explanation about that. Just like I'm naked, or I'm epistemologically naked about what created the universe, you are about what created God. But I'm more able to update my priors because I have the questioning of my priors made explicit, and it doesn't take a funeral to update the priors of this society.
Yeah. Yeah, so the God answer, you know, doesn't answer anything. I mean, I just had a debate with a theologian at a recent conference, and he, you know, basically said, what's your explanation for morality and good and evil? And anyway, I just kind of summarized everything you and I have been talking about for about 10 minutes. And then I said, okay, so that's my explanation. What's yours? He goes, well, you know, God did it. It's like, but that's not an explanation. I mean, how did God do it? Why did God do it? What was the process? I mean, you can't just say that, right? It's not an answer. It's just so frustrating.
But what is funny is that the same process of decentering that we've been going through as we understand more of how the universe works, and so it's kind of like zooming out. That when you're looking at your ass, you think that you are the most important thing in the world. But as you zoom out, you realize your neighborhood, your city, your country, your continent, your planet, your solar system, your galaxy, the universe, the multiverse. And then you realize that you're a speck of dust in top of a rock floating around in a solar system, which is absolutely, it's just a corner of a corner. And that decentering that happens is something that the religious people really don't like, because they have to pretend that there is something that tells you how to do, how to behave properly. And yes, you did a podcast with Stephen Meyer. And I think that's one of the people in the religious community who's at the right end of the distribution, who's accepting into it the latest findings of what is scientific, whatever we figure out, let's make it cohere with whatever I want to end up with. My last conclusion is that God exists. So how can I take whatever was the case until now, like religious people have been doing for 2,000 years, and not happily so. There's been people burned and for proposing that the center of the solar system is not the Earth. But this guy is taking just whatever we believe to be now and saying, well, that's compatible with my interpretation of God because God created the laws of nature. And the laws of nature and God are the same. And of course, that's non-falsifiable. But what I bet is that in 20, 30, 40, 50 years, if our understanding of how the universe works improves, whatever he's now stating will have to be put in stone or frozen, because you don't have, it's a bad explanation. This is something that David Deutsch has talked a lot about. It's a bad explanation that it's hard to vary. And then whatever he says now is the right explanation of how the world works that coheres with God will update slower than whatever our understanding will be. And in 50 years, we will look back and say, well, this guy was only making cohere whatever we knew then with his understanding of God, which is exactly what religious people have been doing for the last thousands of years.
Yeah, it's rather amusing. Yeah, well, Myers he's really smart. He's a sharp guy. He knows his material. He follows the science. And okay, what's the latest, right? But you know, ultimately, he has the same explanation we all do, or the same problem of hitting rock bottom epistemologically. You know, so let's say the James Webb Space Telescope continues to find new things that just don't quite fit. Like they're finding these galaxies early on in the after the Big Bang that appear to be too fully developed for, you know, the current model of how galaxies develop, whatever it is. Not my field, but basically I'm reading these articles going, huh, that's weird. Now my astronomer and cosmology friends tell me, don't worry, the Big Bang theory is still fine. We're not overturning that yet at the moment. We just need to fine-tune it, tweak it, or whatever. That's normal science. That's just how it goes. The bigger the telescopes get, the more things change. And so the theologian, though, is always chasing that, right? They're not leading it. They're chasing it. They're saying, oh, okay, well, okay, if this is true, then how am I going to make this fit with my biblical interpretation or whatever? But ultimately, even if you say, well, okay, like if you take Lee Smolin's theory of a Darwinian cosmology where, you know, that the laws of nature, the way that they are, give rise to stars that end up in collapsing black holes that create new universes. And any universe that has laws of nature similar to ours is more likely to give birth to stars that become black holes that gives, you know, birth to new universes. And those that don't just go extinct, right? It's kind of a Darwinian model of cosmology. But ultimately, like, but how did all that get started in the first place? You know, well, the multiverse. Yeah, okay. The multiverse. Yeah, I like that idea. But where did all that stuff come from? You know, you could just keep asking. And at some point, you go, I don't know. Nobody knows, right? You know, what was there before time began? It's a meaningless question, right? And the theologians answer, well, that's where we put the God explanation. But that doesn't explain anything. You know, if you say, well, God is not a being inside the universe. It's out, you know, God is outside of the universe or outside of space and time. Well, where? Well, not, you can't even ask where. That's not even the right question. There's no where. Okay, what does that mean? Then you get the kind of obfuscating language. You know, it's the, you know, God is the ground of all being. What does that mean? I mean, this is like Deepak Chopra's explanation of consciousness. You know, it's the ground of all being. He just took that phrase. What does that mean? I mean, it's just a word, right? And my analogy is that, like with dark energy and dark matter, these are two of the big mysteries in cosmology. What are they? But when cosmologists, astronomers talk about dark energy and dark matter, they don't mean that as an explanation. They're just saying, we have to call it something because we have to talk to each other. But we're going to now try to find out what that is. You know, are they neutrinos or is it some, you know, anti-gravity thing that causes the universe to expand? And even now, apparently, that's being challenged. The accelerating expansion of the universe is being challenged again. Anyway, whatever. But to them, that's just like, those are just words we're using. We're going to keep lurking and see if we can find the stuff, right? The energy, the matter. But for the theologian, you know, the God did it. That's the end of the answer for them, the search. That is the answer, but it isn't an answer. That's ultimately the problem. And, you know, they have the same problem. What was there before the multiverse or whatever? What was there before God? Where did God come from? Well, God is eternal and doesn't need to be created. Okay, maybe the universe is eternal and doesn't need to be created. Why can't you just say that, right? I mean, we're just talking, using sentences, right? At some point, we hit the kind of hit the foundation, hit rock bottom and can't go any further.
Well, you know what? That's your gap in your knowledge. And that's exactly where Jesus stands. Coincidentally, I didn't intend it to be that way, but that's where Jesus is. And you have to accept it now because you don't know how to explain everything like it had to be. It's kind of unfalsifiable and it had to be always like that. So dark matter is the newest of the gaps that we have in our knowledge. We don't explain how it is that universe is expanding, as you said. But okay, so maybe God has something to say about that. And I think that it's super obfuscating, exactly as you said, that it has a pretension to generality, to say that it is objective, that it applies to everyone. But do you know what really is objective? Or not objective, sorry. Objective, there's only apes under credence in this universe. There's really nothing else that we are handling with. So that, the importance of dialogue is supreme. So I shouldn't say objective. But the thing we have the most confidence on, that is the most general, the knowledge that travels the most, is evolutionary psychology, the humanistic enlightenment that you guys have been talking about for so many years. That is the most general. That is what gives you the biggest insight into our nature that travels the most. Not your parochial beliefs about something that emerged 2,000 years ago with whatever people used to believe back then. It's funny that I see a deep analogy here with the wokes, because we come into an understanding that you have to make a general statement. If I say, well, Michael, that microphone you have should be mine. And you say, why? Well, I don't have a good answer, but just because this is my place and this is more important of a place than yours. And I see that at a special spot, and that's why I should have what your microphone. But that's absurd. And everyone gets that. That's why they have to have the pretension to generality, because it wouldn't fly. It would be dead on arrival. And that's why they can. So they use that enlightenment learning that you have to apply something to be general and not specifically about your parochial and selfish interests. And then they use that and they have the pretension themselves that, oh, no, this is general. This applies everywhere in the whole universe. And that's where they introduce their own parochialness, which is interestingly, and I would love to hear your thoughts about that, what the woke people and the progressive types do. They pretend to be against discrimination when learning from the Enlightenment. Okay, so people shouldn't be discriminated for arbitrary reasons like their sex, gender, race, sexuality. All of those things are arbitrary things that if you're discriminated for, that should be fought against. Cool. Yeah, but so you take that thing and you camouflage yourself around it and you put a veneer of enlightenment so that you can introduce your Trojan horse and introduce all your authoritarianism. So it's an enlightenment with a veneer of enlightenment that allows the bullshit to be introduced. It's like a Trojan horse.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's left-wing authoritarianism, the mirror of right-wing authoritarianism that our position is right, and you're going to go along with it or else. Well, that's not liberal, classical liberalism and enlightenment values. I mean, just take the trans issue, for example, because I've been on this for a couple of years now. We've covered this in Skeptic. You know, the sense amongst liberals is, well, I should be tolerant of trans people. I mean, what somebody wants to do in the privacy of their lives is none of my business. And yeah, you should not be fired or discriminated against just because you identify as the other sex or you're binary or you're whatever it is, non-binary, I guess it is, or whatever it is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I agree. Right. But then when it comes down to conflicting rights, so this is the problem. Life is full of conflicts. You can't have everything. Thomas Sowell always made this point. There's no perfect solutions. They're just compromises that we always make. The rights of the fetus, the rights of the mother, whatever. You have these conflicts. The rights of trans people to live the lives as they want. Yeah, I like that idea. But and so I should be able to, I as a man should be able to go into any women's locker room that I want or compete against girls in girls' sports. No. No, sorry. No, you don't get to do that. You can't do that. You're violating somebody else's rights, right? So you're right. My right to swing my arm ends at your nose. I mean, that's classical liberalism. I can't do anything. I'm not free to drive on either side of the road that I want. I have to drive on the right side of the road. That's the way it goes. And I'm going to be punished and ticketed and fined and even jailed if I don't. you know? And so that's what life is like. And so it always comes down to, you know, are you violating somebody else's rights? And I think the pendulum is now swinging on the woke movement regarding trans issues. I think most people are, I mean, the vast majority of people are on board with protecting women's sports, women's spaces, women's locker rooms, women's prisons, and so on. And we've seen the violations of that enough that everybody's like, that's enough of that. And even if the woke people are still on board in their head, they realize we're going to keep losing elections and it's a very unpopular position, so we better change. But I'd really like them to look at themselves and look at their positions and go, you know what, that I was wrong about that, you know. And ultimately, what's the problem with it? It comes down to biology and nature, right? You can't change sex. That's just the way it is. It's not the same thing. And I'll just finish my riff on that, you know, the idea of being tolerant of gays and lesbians, it feels like to liberals, well, we did that, you know, we had civil rights and then women's rights and then gay rights. And this seems like the next thing I should be behind, but it's different. Right there, you know, people really are attracted to the opposite sex or the same sex, and they really are mostly, we think, just born that way. That's just biology. But you cannot change sex. You can't. That's just impossible. Sex is defined by gametes, and your whole body is designed by evolution to produce one kind of gamete or another. The fact that there's chromosomal aberrations, there's XXY, XYY, and Klinefelter syndrome and so on, is meaningless. I mean, it proves my point, really. You know, the fact that there are people with six fingers doesn't mean that fingerness is on a spectrum. You know, most of us have five fingers. Okay, same thing. Anyway, I think you know, the adherence to biological facts helps people adjust their morals there, and the concept of conflicting rights. Yeah, you should be tolerant of trans or whatever anybody wants to be. They could be a furry. They could, I don't care, you know, but if you're violating somebody else's rights, then that is an anti-liberal position.
Yeah, what you just stated is a proof that fitness determines morality. Because the wokes and the progressive types, when they found that they were going to lose their enough votes by advocating for these policies, they changed their morality. So the thing underlying whatever morality we have is fitness. And the most obfuscatory example that I face every single time I utter this is, what if the Nazis won the Second World War? Well, would then fitness have won, and would that determine our values? What is the position from which you're asking that question? You're asking from the position of being able to counter it. You are something that's not that, and you're countering it. So the mere existence, the mere fact that you exist here to utter it, it means that you're somewhat fit. So there's something outside of it that's fit enough to counter it. And so the only way you can counter Nazism is with that. And this is exactly how the Nazis lost in the Second World War, because of the US and the Soviet Union, which was something external to them fighting them off. And internally could also have happened, but that's a different story. There's no other way. Whatever set of values will make you the fittest are the set of values that will be true. Or there's no other means by which we could justify anything. If whatever you believe in will lead to your inexistence, okay, try advocating for them then. It's just nonsensical. And another comment you made about these progressives advocating for trans rights, not wanting to dissolve borders, this is basically the moral relativism, that there's no borders that should be respected. Everything is a construct and can be interpreted away. So the difference between men and women can be interpreted away. But there's a reason why we separate men and women in sports. That discrimination, that men cannot compete with women, comes from the fact that a fight between a man and a woman is not only boring because it's not the same level of competence, but it's distasteful. You don't want to see a man fighting with a woman. The wokes properly claim that there are some borders should be stumbled upon and just destroyed because it's just a parochial convention, but not all are. We have some solid borders. Sex is one. And once you fight against that, you're fighting against truth, and you will lose elections if you keep fighting truth. So try fighting the laws of nature. Come on, it's ridiculous. And I would, a very good way to prove this is one-upping them. and saying, okay, so we can destroy the border of sex, right? Why don't we destroy the border of species? What if I identify myself as a horse? Can I be a horse? Of course not. That's fucking ridiculous. But if they go with that, okay, then let me be an Apache helicopter. Can I be a Apache helicopter and be something that's not alive? Or the sun. I want to be the sun. It's just utterly ridiculous. There are borders, there's categories that make sense, that match into the environment. And if you keep breaking things, you will find something that breaks you.
That's nicely put. Yes, I agree with all that. So it's an interesting idea about kind of the long-term historical trend toward more democracies and fewer autocracies. So you mentioned the Nazis. You know, centuries ago, you know, I don't know, maybe 500 years ago, you know, it was just autocracies everywhere. I mean, it just everybody was, you know, had leviathans like that that just kind of ruled over their citizens and fought amongst themselves, and conflicts were quite common, and the abuse of citizens was not unusual, and so on. So what made the Nazis different was that there was enough other people around the world that said, this is not good if this continues to spread. And, you know, when the Nazis first came online in the early 30s, you know, they did some good things economically. You know, the Great Depression had spread throughout Europe and so on. And, you know, kind of Hitler turned the economy around and, you know, built the autobahns and, you know, got the people back to work and, you know, pride and all that. So all that's fine. But by the time they turned exterminationist against the Jews and others, by the time, you know, the military really started becoming more active after, you know, they invaded Poland, it was too late for anybody to object, right? So the idea that citizens should have a say in what a country does was gone in Germany. Everybody could see there was thousands of concentration camps set up. Thousands of them. And you could see your neighbors disappearing who objected to whatever the policies of the nation were by 1939. So they just, you know, most people could not object. So it took outside democracies to say, all right, we're going to put a stop to this because we don't want this to spread worldwide, right? But that is an unusual thing. You know, in the past, like genocide, I mean, even that's a new idea. That term, genocide, was coined Raphael Lemkin in 1945. Basically describe what the Nazis did to the Jews and others. You know, the intentional extermination of an entire race of people or group of people with the intent of eliminating them completely, right? That idea is very old. I mean, this used to happen all the time. And no one really objected to it as long as it didn't happen to them, right? So it's different in the modern world to say, and to your point about universalizing the concept, we should not do that. It's not just as long as it doesn't happen to you, it shouldn't happen to anybody, right? That's a new idea. And so I do think there's a long-term trend, not inevitable, just based on our understanding of human nature, that most people do not want to live under those conditions. And if you ask them, they'll tell you. And you can see that just in how they vote with their feet, you know. And so that's why, in truth, I asked, you know, would you rather live in North Korea or South Korea? Well, everybody goes, well, obviously. Why is it obvious? Why? Well, because I'd rather be 3 inches taller. I'd rather have food to eat. I'd rather have potable water. And I'd like to have electricity and healthcare and, you know, just the modern normal stuff that North Koreans don't have or have in a fewer amounts. So, you know, ultimately, I think there'll be fewer and fewer of those kinds of regimes just because that's not what people want. Given the choice, they'll reject it. Now, you're always going to find exceptions. You know, do women really want to undergo a clitorectomy under Islamic law? You know, you could find somebody that says, yes, I like it. You know, some woman that says it was a Muslim woman. And so, but really, the vast majority of women will say, no, I don't want that. I want freedom. Or, you know, the other problem with, you know, that line of argument is that a lot of people in oppressed regimes like this have no idea what it means to be free. They don't even know what the choice is. What does it mean to be educated? If you don't even know what that is, you know, why would you even bother answering the question, right? So if you only know one way of living, you know, it's like on a more trivial matter, the Mormons with their polygamist beliefs, you know, and a lot of these young girls will go, I'm on board, or teenage girls, but I'm on board with polygamy. You know, I'm going to marry this guy or whatever, but they don't know any different. This is how they were raised from the get-go. You know, when you're 16, you're going to marry that old guy who's 60 years old down the road. Okay. They don't know, right? I mean, so knowledge about what's natural for humans and so on, you know, of course, some rich, powerful old guys like having lots of young women to have sex with, but no one ever asks the women, how do you feel about it? You know, given a choice, right? If you actually know what's going on, you have the choice, then, you know, polygamy will not work, right? Anyway, that's just kind of some riffing on that.
And interestingly, if you allow the local variation to happen among the Mormons, the women would rediscover what monogamy, and they, oh, this guy is for me exclusively. He wants to invest his whole time into our kids, and this other guy doesn't give a single fuck about me. I like the first one more. So if you allow the variation within the Mormons, the same thing that the powerful men are advocating for, and there's a reason for it, because it increases fitness, but it's a evolutionary appendix. Well, the appendix does do something, but how was this archaeological, architectural thing that is a spandrel?
Yes, the arches.
Exactly. The fact that men want to have sex with many women is an evolutionary spandrel. There's a reason for it. Of course, your genes spread more, but in our current environment, it becomes a spandrel because it's not functional anymore. So we have to restrain ourselves. Just like being angry in the road is stupid. You're not going to make any difference by someone cutting you off and now shouting at them and speeding to catch with them. It's utterly ridiculous. We have to realize we have a prefrontal cortex for a reason, to be able to see our environment and adapt our behavior to whatever the environment is, because the genes couldn't see it. So memes emerged out of genes to adapt to the environment faster than the genes could. And if you are becoming angry and wanting to fuck many women, you're regressing a couple million years in evolution. It's utterly absurd.
Well, of course you could do that, but then you're probably not going to be married. you're gonna sacrifice some other value, like a long-term loving relationship or something like that, right? I mean, we're programmed by nature to want to have as many babies as possible. That's how the species survives. But I can just use birth control, and I don't have to do that. You know, that's the beauty of the modern world. We are able to increase the number of choices we have by controlling nature. Anyway.
Two points. The second one, I will address this latest intervention. I remember that you mentioned that what the Nazis did in the 30s in Germany was good because they created a lot of prosperity. I think that's one of the biggest arguments the Keynesians used to justify governmental intervention. But that's entirely due to catch up. Their conversion with whatever is a better version, a less entropic recipe of an economy. Sure. Yeah. They were catching up with the US. They were copy and pasting whatever worked there. And now let's bring it top down here like the Chinese did. But there's no way you can take over a country which is lower entropy with authoritarianism. The only thing that innovates, and this is something that your friend Matt Ridley has talked a lot about, the innovation doesn't work top down, it works bottom up. And if you have a very good recipe, if you have a very good model, very good intelligence that is being developed in the West, then you can copy it in China, sure, but try making it one up, try one up in it in intelligence, it won't work.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah, obviously some of these things are short-term. Keynesian economics works on the short term, but ultimately, you know, it has to be a bottom-up process. I mean, it's like the breaking windows is a good thing because it gives glassmakers something to do and increases their income. Yeah, but in the long run, this is not good for, you know, the people that own the building where the windows are broken or whatever, you know. So yeah.
It's always a thing about marginal returns. So what is the thing? Because the time we are investing, if you're buying a repair of a glass, you're making that person invest his time into doing that when he could have been doing something marginally better. And so the fewer needs we have, the better the economy becomes. This is something I'm personally particularly frugal, or let's say I try to be stoic and not need things. I don't drink alcohol. I try to consume the least possible. And people say, well, that's bad for the economy. You've got no fucking clue how the economy works, dude. My the money I'm saving is being invested in things that have a lower time preference, things that are actually satisfying the need that will come in a decade, not the thing that comes in 1 minute because you are obese and you need the next hamburger. So do you think that's a virtuous investment, your hamburger? Come on. I am the only one being able to think about the next 10 years. You're thinking about the hamburger is the thing destroying the economy. Not money cannot be spent. Cannot be not spent. It has to be invested somewhere, just like your attention. So it's a matter of investing what we have, our time, in the best way possible. And buying the hamburger or repairing that glass that didn't need repairing is not the right thing.
It's like Friedrich Bastiat's idea of the what is seen and what is not seen. You know, you see how the money is spent. Oh, we got the government built this beautiful highway or bridge. But what are the opportunity costs to do that? What the money was not spent on building a school or whatever. And that applies to all our lives, of course. Now, in terms of economics and trust, you know, you have to have trust that the system is going to work, or else your time horizon should actually be short. It would be more rational to have a short time horizon. If you have no idea if money is going to be in the bank tomorrow, you're better off keeping it in the mattress or spending it today rather than tomorrow. I was thinking about the famous marshmallow test. You know, could give children a choice to have one marshmallow now or wait 15 minutes, delay gratification, and get two marshmallows. And everybody always talks about how great it is to delay gratification. And those kids had higher GPAs and longer marriages, made more money in their lives, and so on and so forth, lower body mass index. And in general, it's good to have a longer time horizon, save for the future, you know, plan, you know, be patient and so on. Yes, but if you live in a low trust environment, you know, if you're in a family in which you have a lot of siblings who steal your food or you're hanging around bad people or whatever, you better eat the marshmallow now, because there may not only might there not be a second marshmallow, there might not even be a first marshmallow left if somebody takes it, right? So it would be rational to just grab it now if the environment is so bad, so low in trust. And that's why economists talk about trust as a value in a country, determining its GDP is, you know, you got to have property rights and contracts and a legal system and so forth, or else, you know, the whole thing falls apart.
Exactly. I think it's a law of nature that things move from less liquidity to more liquidity. So liquidity in economics is just how easy something is to sell, but not only across space, so me to you, but also me to you in 20 years. So the most liquid thing across time is not the dollar. The dollar is not liquid across time. It's liquid across space. And so, of course, if you're going to have an inflating currency, you're going to seek something else. So if a parasite, be it your sister or your brother who's going to steal your food, or the government who's going to steal your money by having a bigger deficit and not creating a bigger inflation, you're going to buy the next thing that's at least more liquid than that, which is my fat cells in my belly. At least those will lose value less fast than the government can go into a deficit. So at least I will save it in that way. Mm-hmm. And there's just an inferior technology. I don't know how interested you are in this economic thinking, but I think the next step is finding the next thing that's the most illiquid, or the most liquid, sorry. And by far, the thing that people have been finding for thousands of years is gold. It's not a coincidence. It always goes up in value more than inflation, because it's a stock-to-flow ratio. It has a lot of explanation behind it. And the ultimate step is Bitcoin, but I don't want to make this a sales pitch. I just wanted to explain. I just wanted to make this the explanation of what I think is the economics behind it. Sorry.
Well, it would be interesting to see what happens in the long run. I mean, gold has only recently gone way up. You know, it's been pretty stable forever. It doesn't do much compared to the stock market. I mean, if you just have a mutual fund in the S&P 500 and just let it sit there for 30 years, you're going to make a lot more money than if you put all that in gold. Now, maybe that'll change. You know, it was in January is about $5,000 an ounce. Now it's down to about $4,200 an ounce, I think, something like that. But forever, it was at like $1,500 to $1,800 an ounce for, you know, years and years and years. So I don't know what's going to happen with that or Bitcoin. You know, I don't have any Bitcoin investments. Mine's all just in the stock market because it works. You know, will the Bitcoin work? I don't know. Maybe. But I'm not going to be the test pilot for that one.
Yes, you're right. I think buying. So let me see if you agree with this framing. Buying the stock market is being bullish on human ingenuity. You think that people are going to figure out new solutions, new gadgets, new things that are going to improve our lives. But if you buy gold, you're shorting human ingenuity. You're believing that the stock to flow ratio of gold, which is 50, there's 50 times more stock than flow comes every year to the market, to 2% inflation, that we're not going to be smart enough to break that. I wouldn't, just the same way that the ultimate example of this is the US. I don't have the balls to bet against the US. The US has the best demography, the best geography, the best everything. It's just a superpower. And it will be almost for every conceivable time period that you can think of. So betting against human ingenuity is just, it's kind of self-defeating. If you are ingenious enough to find a good investment, why would you believe that others cannot be ingenious enough to do so?
That's why I like tech stocks, you know, the Magnificent Seven, the Mag Seven, right? You know, Apple and Google and Intel and Amazon and Netflix, all those, they're great because they're very innovative. Now, maybe Apple and Google, they'll get so huge and bureaucratic or whatever, but still, they're very successful and innovative. And I don't know. If I knew what was next, maybe I'd bet on that. There are people that speculate about that. I don't know. You know, AI is a big thing. You know, the AI companies have done very well. So, you know, those are good investments. You know, what's next after the iPhone? You know, that was Apple's big invention, and it's huge, 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 hugely successful. You know, is there something beyond that? I don't know. You know, it's like from VHS tapes, Blockbuster, to Netflix mailing out DVDs. DVDs was the next technology. That's all gone. You know, streaming now. Okay, what's after streaming? I don't know. Maybe a chip in my brain from Elon's Neuralink and I just watch the movie in my head. I don't have to stream it on my computer. I don't really know. If I knew, maybe I'd invest in it or something. But this is the problem with innovation is that it's impossible to predict what people are going to want. I mean, Steve Jobs famously said, I don't care what anybody wants. I'm telling them what they want. Right? But on some level, he must have had a sense like this is going to go big, right? And I saw that immediately with the iPod because I used to listen to books on tape. I hundreds, thousands of books on tape over the decades. And so books on tape, I used to get the box of tapes, cassette tapes in the mail that the company would send me, and I'd mail it back when I was done. And I would stuff these cassette tapes into my jersey pockets for my long bike rides. And I'd have to stop and flip the tape over. And then the Sony Walkman invented this new device, this new technology where it would automatically play the cassette tape back the other direction. So I didn't have to stop and flip the tape over, right? And that was exciting. And then when Jobs comes out with the iPod, it's like, it's all in this one box. I'm like, oh my God, that's it. It's over, right? The books on tape people, they're going out of business. If they don't get into the streaming business, it's over. And that's right.
It's almost an epistemological thing that forces its same dynamics into business. I don't know if you have had a chat with David Deutsch on your podcast, but you absolutely should. The conversation he had with Sam Harris is absolutely brilliant. It's among the best things I've ever listened to. So David Deutsch, he wrote The Beginning of Infinity, and it's one of the biggest advocates of the Enlightenment thought about in the broadest of the senses and the power of explanations. So and he said that, well, I don't think he said this, but this would be me paraphrasing him to the extent to which I can do it in a fair way, I think. If you could predict the next innovation, you would bring into being the next innovation. Mm-hmm. And so there's no sense. If you're not going to be the one pulling off a 10 trillion market cap company, you probably cannot predict it, because predicting and making are the same thing epistemologically. Mm.
Yeah, I love Deutsch. I've not had him on the show. I did film an in-person conversation with him last year that we're going to release. The Beginning of Infinity was a game changer. I mean, it's a great book. Nothing prohibited by the laws of nature. We can do anything we want that's not prohibited by the laws of nature. That's it. And so it's all just ideas, explanations, innovation. It's all just, you know, let's just see what the solution is. And so I think that's a very optimistic way of looking at the future. You know, there are some, maybe some restrictions based on the laws of nature, like, you know, becoming an interstellar species could be difficult because the space distances are so far. But there's lots of solutions that people have come up with about how to combat that. You know, time dilation, you know, you just go near the speed of, accelerate to near the speed of light so that on your clock, you get, you know, to the other star fairly quickly. Even though everyone on Earth is aged, you know, very, very, very greatly, they'll be all long dead and gone by the time you get there, but you'll still be alive. Okay, and that's one solution. You know, maybe there's some other anti-gravity things, whatever. You know, I hear about all these things with the UAP, UFO business, right? You know, warping of space-time. It's like, okay, you've been watching too much Star Trek, right? I'm not sure this is actually possible. You know, there are people that say that it could be, you know, but it's all very theoretical. But yeah, so if it's possible, yeah, that's one argument I have for why it would be great to live 500 years, be chronically frozen and brought back or whatever, just to see what people come up with. Like, oh my God, I had no idea. Imagine somebody like a really innovative guy like a Thomas Edison being shown an iPhone or a laptop, or like he'd be like, oh my God, this is so exciting. This is so cool. I had no idea this was possible just by electricity, right? And yeah, so it would be interesting what in 500 years from now, what people will be doing. I have no idea, but it's got to be cool.
Interestingly, all of these steps that we've been taking look, in retrospect, and only in retrospect, they look inevitable. Of course,
yes.
We
yes.
had information technology becomes more dense, more efficient, more high throughput, high bandwidth, and technologies move across that spectrum. And you said, of course, after the cassette, the CD had to come, and after that, the MP3. Of course, all of that, though, in retrospect, it looks obvious. And a genius would have been able to bridge the gap between one of the layers and the next one. So I think that if you brought Thomas Edison to one step before where we are now, he would have been able to make the step in some general way. He wouldn't bring the iPhone, but he would bring some touchscreen connected to the internet and some processing behind it to create the apps or the different things that you want to use. And very in line with what Deutsch said, that the right knowledge gives you the ability to do anything not prohibited by the laws of nature. But so I love that. The light that Deutsch brings to this world with his humanistic pro-enlightenment thinking, I love it. But let me now take you to the opposite side, to the darkness. So you mentioned North Korea before. North Korea has a fertility rate of 1.7, 1.8. South Korea has the lowest fertility rate in the world, 0.7, 0.8 kids per woman. What if enlightenment is not fit? What if the enlightenment, the progress, the innovation, the creation of equal rights between all the people, the improvement in living standards, all of that, you get to a point, the pill is discovered, control over our own reproduction so we can get the gratification. We start flying to Bali. We get distracted with things that are not reproduction, while the other ones, the retrograde ones, they keep catching up with us, getting free riding in terms civilizationally. And once you've innovated to a point where you discover the AI or whatever, the thing that is considered to be high enough, your fertility drops, theirs keeps up because they keep oppressing their people in a slave country, in an open air prison, and they catch up. And your numbers go down, their numbers keep going up or staying the same, and they take over the world. What if that is what's ahead of us?
Do you know Stein's law, Herb Stein? Things that can't go on forever won't.
But they can go for a long time.
They can go for a long, yeah, the corollary, go for a lot longer than you think. You know, so for, you know, in the 60s, you know, the overpopulation problem was the big thing. And all the way up until really just recently, and thanks to Elon to make a big deal about this because he has such a huge following that, in fact, for many years now, you know, the replacement, we've been below replacement level for most of the industrial West. And now that's spreading to other countries as well. And so this is a potential problem. Now, first of all, how about some pats on the back for the, you know, the solving the overpopulation problem. We're going to peak out and head back down. Okay, that, you know, you were worried about that. So how about being happy about that? Okay, fine. But of course, you don't want to keep going forever, and then there's no human species. Now, I know Elon's doing his share to solve this problem, but, you know, he's just one guy. He can only do so much. And from my understanding from economists is that there is no like tax incentive solution to get people to have more kids. The government can try. They can offer tax breaks or incentives, or authoritarian governments can actually pay people to have more babies. You know, but that almost never works. It doesn't work. I mean, Ceausescu tried to do that in Romania. And, you know, if people don't want more babies, they're not going to have them. I mean, if you force them to have them, they're just going to leave them at the orphanage or in the trash can or whatever. They're just not going to do it. And, you know, so we're bumping up against certain limits of human nature of what people want. And if they, you know, have the choice and the economic resources, they want fewer children, especially women. So that's, you know, to me, that's a good thing for the most part. More choice is better. Will it continue on till the species disappears? I don't think so, because we still like sex. And, you know, I think people will, you know, the trend will go back toward, you know, more toward 2.0 versus 1.0 on replacement level. I'm fairly optimistic about that just because of how these things tend to go. But who knows? And, you know, back for and to your earlier point, yes, of course, all this could go away. I mean, you know, we could have a reinstitution of slavery, take the vote away from women. Any of this is possible, but it's not very likely with the spread of democracies where women have a choice, where, you know, former slaves don't want to be slaves and they have any kind of power or choice to prevent it from happening, they will. So the only way it could happen would be in an authoritarian regime like a North Korea, where they say, well, these are the limits for women and we're going to have slaves, whatever it is. Yeah, they could do that, but in a very limited way. I mean, people are not migrating to North Korea. They're leaving, right? Or they're not, you know, Americans in Florida are not going to Cuba. Cubans are coming to Florida. Why? They're voting with their feet. And as long as there's enough freedom for that to happen, I don't think the dark side could win out.
Yes, the effective fertility rate, given that a lot of people are trying to leave your shithole and a lot of people are trying to come to this supposed better place, like I did. I come from Spain, particularly from the Basque country. People there are so crazy with nationalism and with socialism. They believe that the state has to do absolutely everything. I was fed up and I left. So I now live in Zurich, Switzerland, the most economically free country I could find in the map, somewhat close to Spain, and that's why I'm here. So that's absolutely true. The effective fertility rate could be higher, is much higher than the numbers and the babies produced are, because you are not discounting the fact that a lot of babies that are being produced in Spain now are going to come here by realizing that's a fucking shit of a system, and this one is much better. So you should move here. That's true. But the same way that you said that there has been a progressive improvement, not inevitable. Again, you said you properly caveated that there has been a progressive improvement in the amount of democracy that there is around the world. What if that just demographically shifts? What if the effective fertility rate that I was talking about is not high enough because we don't get enough migrants, or not getting enough migrants, but not converting enough migrants? Because if my mind was against the establishment in Switzerland, yes, I could make more money, but it would be self-defeating. Switzerland doesn't need socialist Spanish people. It needs libertarian or classical liberal Spanish people who will advocate for the same thing that made Switzerland the great country that it is right now. And if you keep importing people who are socialistic, average Spaniards, like most of the people I know there and most of my family, then you will the country will go to shit, because it's easier to break something that's low entropy than breaking something that's high entropy. I've come to the conclusion that I think I should vote to the most left-leaning party there so that it goes to shit. And the same thing that happened in Argentina, that the economy was so bankrupt at some point that the people were like, oh, let's test something else. Libertarianism might work. And they tested it and the economy is going very well there. So maybe that's the fastest way to liberalism.
Yeah, I like Switzerland. I've been there, but you know, I'm in California. I'm not leaving. We have awful taxes and the gasoline. Oh, I have an electric car, so I don't care. But yeah, I know. But you know, there's certain momentum. There's other values that matter. Yeah, I like Switzerland. I went to a lot of Brunnen Valley and you know, all those mountains. It's beautiful. Yeah, it's great. Yeah. So, but can't have everything.
But the beautifulness of the country is a red herring. When people come here and they say, oh, it's beautiful, who cares about the beautiful? We came here to capitalize, not to watch beautiful right. things. Don't you think that there's plenty of beautiful scenery in Russia? We're not there. Nobody gives a fuck about the scenery. It's only about the capitalism that you, that makes you be here.
Yes, it's the freedom. Absolutely, yeah. Yep.
Exactly. So let me continue the... I brought another red herring with the Switzerland thing, and I didn't give you the time to respond to the previous thing. What if the effective fertility rate of the liberal countries is consistently below that of illiberal ones? What if the Enlightenment is not fit? What if peak civilization is the cockroach? Do you know how the cockroach or crabs get convergent evolution towards? They are ugly, and a butterfly is beautiful, but it's easy to smack and it can die, so they can go into extinction. But a cockroach or a crab that's very ugly, like North Korean authoritarian regime, is something that's very fit and it reproduces a lot. It pumps out millions of eggs and that's it, reproduction successful. But our business model, it's a much more expensive one that has much lower entropy. So given that the second law of thermodynamics, that entropy only increases, why are you so optimistic about enlightenment?
Well, I am by nature rather optimistic as a person, but I do think that, you know, there's good arguments for why this will continue more or less. As Pinker always says, you know, it's not inevitable. It's the kind of thing we have to work at, but we are working at it. And more people care about these things. And yes, there's always reversals. You know, it's three steps forward, two steps back. Okay, fine. You know, could it all turn around? Yeah, of course it could, but unlikely. Again, if women have a choice between voting and not voting, they're going to want to vote. You know, it's just the way it is. People want more choices, more freedom, and so on. Yes, there are some that'll say, I don't want to vote, or I don't think women should vote, or whatever. But the vast majority, who then determine whether women can vote or not, are going to vote that they should, right? So I think that will continue. It's a little bit, what you're bringing up is a little bit like I forget what it's called, Popperian paradox of a tolerant liberal society that tolerates intolerant people, and then ultimately the intolerant people take over, and there's no more tolerance. Okay, if that, you know, that's an old idea, it hasn't happened. Why hasn't it happened? You know, and I think it's because it's not true that, you know, the intolerant people can take over. They don't take over. There's more of us that are tolerant and want free speech, for example. Anyway, so that's my thoughts on that.
Yes, I think that the conservative approach in the US to migration of reducing the numbers is just part of it. The situation has to be affronted at all the levels. So we have to get the best migrants, not the worst ones. We have to make the best integration of those that come, independent of how good they are. We have to integrate them into our society, to take care of them so that they contribute and they do the best they can. And also we have to, maybe this some foreign policy hawk people will like this, but I think to some extent it's true. We have to make sure that the institutions elsewhere move in the right directions. But I think that culturally, that would already happen. There's no need to invade Iraq or Afghanistan. Right. Maybe we're already invading them with enlightenment because it's the most capable thing to spread. It's the thing that travels the farthest, right? So it would be a pity if it didn't spread into Afghanistan.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if I was president, which I'll never be, but I would just open up the trading windows with Cuba, for example. Just lower all the barriers and let all the casino people go down there and open up hotels and golf courses and casino, whatever, businesses, McDonald's, Starbucks, just let everybody have it. And then they would just naturally gravitate toward more freedom. That's what they want. That's why they come here, right? They wouldn't come here anymore if capitalism was in Cuba. I would apply that to any model. Now, part of the problem on the immigration issue is that not everybody thinks like you and I are thinking here. You know, some people think, well, I think it's better if, you know, men rule over everything and women have no choices, or, you know, I believe in a command economy from the top down. You know, okay, then don't come here, right? Then we don't want you. In my earlier libertarian days, where I could imagine no borders at all, people could just come and go as they want, let the economy determine it. Like California, if there's more work here and there's people coming here from Mexico that want to do the work that people here don't want to do, mostly the gardening stuff and weed whacking and all the kind of crap jobs that they want to do, all the farming stuff, fine. What do I care? I'm happy not to do it. It's hard work, right? I have a big piece of property here. I have to weed whack. The fire department requires us to weed whack it all for fire prevention. And so when I bought the weed whacker machine, I got out there because I'm kind of athletic. I like to do things myself. And it's like, crap, this is hard work. Oh my God. These guys are out here doing this in like 3 days. They clear like 5 acres. Like, oh my God, this would take me 6 months. Right. So I'm happy that they're doing it. You know, now millions are here and now there's a system in which they can get free stuff. It's like, no, it's not going to work. You know, the economy cannot determine how many people come here based on work alone if you're giving them free stuff, you know, healthcare and whatever and all the, you know, birthright citizenship. And in California, in hospitals, for example, the way the law works is if like a pregnant woman can come here from Mexico at the last moment and just walk into the ER and just water break, she's giving birth, they got to take care of her. Then the baby is now an American citizen. It's like, okay. That's not the economy determining what, you know, when people are coming and going. That's other things. And that's, you know, so that's the problem with all immigration is that not everybody's the same, right? So my favorite movie on this, A Few Good Men, is when Jack Nicholson schools Tom Cruise about this, you know, you can't handle the truth. What's the truth? You know, we live in a world with walls and on those walls are men with guns. Why is that? Because some people don't want the stuff that we want. So keep them out. You know, you go live somewhere else. Just don't come here, right? I wish it wasn't that way, but it is, so okay.
But the welfare state, which in reality should be called the welfare of the state, is the opposite of that. It creates the wrong incentives. It attracts the people who don't come to be productive. If you give a subsidy, and that's the reason why someone is coming, it's for the short-term gratification that they are expecting to have. It's analogous to a young woman showing too much of her body too early, it's going to attract the attention of some men that you don't want in your life. And the kind of men that you want in your life will come from the long-term project that you are able to build being shown, not the short-term gratification from a three-minute ejaculation that a man can have on you. It's analogous to the subsidies, I think, that if you are signaling the ability to give someone immediate gratification, the type of instincts that you're going to bring here, the type of people are going to be psychopathic. And it's not that they are psychopathic. In part, of course, there's psychopaths everywhere, but you're making them psychopathic by giving them this kind of welfare of the state policies that make the state grow and grow. So this is something that Jordan Peterson would probably love.
Yeah, well, and then the other problem is once the bureaucracies start to grow, it appears to be next to impossible to make them smaller. It's almost like a law of nature. You know, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. All the Republicans, when they get into power, they go, we're going to cut this stuff back. We're going to reduce the bureaucracy. And they never do, right? We're going to reduce the deficit. They never do. They grow it just as much as the Dems. I don't know why, other than this is what bureaucracies do. They just get bigger.
It's what you said, the unseen part. It's there's an asymmetry between both sides. The fiat holder doesn't feel the deficit as much as the military industrial complex getting the new F-16 being delivered to them in 10x the amount. It's something very asymmetric. You have very well-organized people in one side and very disorganized taxpayer in the other side. And of course, parasitism would increase. But I think that with every system, there's a point of equilibrium. If you put a flame to an object, the object will warm up until the radiation coming out of it is equivalent to the radiation coming in. So I think that the stupidity of the taxpayer, not the stupidity, but its inability to coordinate will be compensated at some point with pressure from itself that you're poor, you're paying so much taxes, you're being stolen everything you have. At some point, you will have to react. And there's different things that we can make to increase that, the speed at which that happens, increase the surface area of this hypothetical object that's being heated, like the values of the enlightenment. Because the more progressive and the more left-leaning that the politics are, the more parasitism it will take for people to realize that this is not working, this is dysfunctional. Bureaucracy has to shrink.
Yeah. Hey, Alex, I got to wrap up in 5 minutes because I got another last podcast point. I got to record. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. You said that that money in this country you mentioned didn't buy babies, and it also didn't in Hungary. It doesn't. Money doesn't work. What does make a difference is status. Even though it's a zero-sum game, if you perceive that, if you perceive like the people who are the best in society are having a lot of babies, that's what people will go for. And I think that if trips to Bali. As libertarian as I am, are not properly taxed because they create a huge externality. You going to Bali now is creating a deficit in kids because you're being distracted by the flashy thing that you can afford now and signaling Instagram that you have status. So the status should be redirected towards what is actually productive. It's kind of a market failure that the market's not being able to internalize properly. And I don't know if the state failure will be a solution to that, because certainly if there's someone good at creating negative externalities, it's the state. So what are your thoughts on that? Is there any way to internalize these negative
status? Yes. Okay. Well, maybe so. If Elon has a lot of status and he has 17 kids or whatever he's got, you know, maybe that'll nudge things in the other direction. I don't know. I do think people are highly motivated by economics. You know, what can they afford? How much extra expenses do they want? You know, having kids is expensive. I have two kids. I spent a lot of money on children. It's amazing how much cheaper it would be if I didn't have any kids, but I like having kids. So I don't know. It's, you know, there's a mix there, I guess, of psychology, economic status, all that stuff. Maybe the status would work. I don't know. I mean, the economists I've talked to about this say, you know, all the tax stuff that governments can do just generally don't work, although they try. I mean, I get a tax break for owning a home, for example. I get a tax break for having kids. I get a tax break for driving an electric car. At least I used to. I think that's about to end because there's so many of them now. But anyway, I think there's only so much governments can do. People are just going to do whatever they do.
Yes. Last thing. I would like to read to you a passage of an article I wrote with neuroscientist Carl Friston, and then you give me your thoughts and we wrap it up there.
Okay.
So this is called Collapsing is a Knot. All values remain provisional and updatable, perhaps except this one. That values remain updatable holds the cultural position of the first law of thermodynamics. Culture, memes, emerge from biology, genes, to map to the environment faster than genes could. Opposing free speech is regressing a couple million years of evolution. If we talk about things, our knowledge updates faster than one funeral at a time. The purpose of dialogue is to let ideas die instead of us. Where open inquiry reigns, trust doesn't need to be put in the wrong places for long. This is the scientific method, in essence. The traditional distinction between what is and values, what ought to be, is a specious philosophical boundary. The naturalistic fallacy that science and morality, understanding and values are orthogonal is itself a fallacy. There's nothing unnatural about that idea. It's just wrong. What else than from the right is, the right understanding, the right explanation, the is that makes the that matches the environment, could we derive a not from? Moral rules and ethical convictions are like all other pieces of knowledge, predictions that must be hosted by a physical is, a human body, a brain, or a population. They are themselves made of other predictions. If a population adopts a knot that is existentially, that is functionally incompatible with reality, it leads to their disappearance. If a knot leads to an existential is not extinction, that belief is proven wrong in the most literal sense. There's no one left to sustain it. Vice and virtue, morality and immorality are defined by fitness in the long term. What else could they be defined by? Norms that allow societies to persist tend to stabilize, while those that destroy their careers are chiseled out of the world. Just like an exuberant virus runs out of hosts to infect and disappears, this is why morality across all cultures converge into a specific set of workable rules, such as honesty and reciprocity. Two more paragraphs. The distinction between science and morality is an illusion, a dogma-inducing regressive one. Every ethical stand is a provisional hypothesis to be falsified by further evidence. From where, if not from understanding how the world works, would we derive the rules for how to behave? Some will say religion, but religion very much embodies, in an implicit way, countless iterations of the same variation and selection, signal and noise, sometimes a lot of hard-to-update vestigial noise harnessed through the centuries. In other words, morality and our internal models are governed by the same laws of nature. Every thought, every choice, every action in and of itself is a prediction tested and updated against reality. Last one. To live is to act on predictions that have been refined over billions of years. The moral universe is not above us. It is within the patterns that have survived for long enough. Every breath we take, every choice we make, is both a proof of what works and a wager on what can survive. To exist is to already have solved, however imperfectly, the problem of how to live by allocating correctly one's trust.
Wow, that was great, Alex. That was good. You wrote that?
Yes.
Oh my gosh, yes. Well, send that to me. We'll publish it in Skeptic. Or send me an article making that case. Yeah, that was beautifully done. I agree with that. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, these words we use, morality, science, whatever, and these are different departments and fields of study or whatever. But really, it's, you know, you boil it down to just knowledge, you know, about the world. That's what we really, really want to know. So thanks for having me.
Thank you. I'll send you the article. It's okay. Called Trust is a Law of Nature.
Trust is a Law of Nature. I love it. That's great. Yeah, that'd be good. All right.
Perfect. It was a pleasure, Michael. See you.
Okay, Alex.